Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Go Global Fast, where globalization and cultural awareness meet heart and soul. Come along and gain practical insights about how to deal with many cultures at once with sensitivity and grace. And here are the hosts of Go Global Fast, Dr. Tyra Kobayeva and Deborah Brown.
Well, welcome to the show, Go Global Fast. And I'll tell you, it is going to be a fast 1 hour today because we're going to be talking about things that, I don't know, I think we're going to go far and wide with conversation about language. Things about language can take us really, really amazing places, starting with things like buns of steel and body of steel. But I'm teasing with that. We'll come back to that in a little bit. I'm Deborah Brown, and my wonderful co-host, chime in if you will.
The co-host is chiming in, but the co-host was warned by people who are transcribing the show that she continuously interrupts her co-host. Therefore, she is afraid now to pipe in too much because she's afraid she will be interrupting. So give me the green light. Otherwise, I will be sheepishly sitting on the sidelines regretting my bad behavior.
Absolutely not going to work that way because that means you're not giving your 100%, so that's not going to work. No, and this is going to be an interesting show today because we left off last time talking about the idea that we are global by default. And I think we were talking about the fact that, you know, businesses and people can ask themselves, how do I become more global? How can I take my business global? How can I do this? As if it's a proactive conversation or a proactive thing that we're trying to strategize. But you put forth the idea that we are actually global by default. And I want to start there because I know what you mean, but it almost scares me to think that we are pretty much out of choices. You know, we have to be global.
You see, sounds like true American to me. I'm just being facetious and I'm being Russian right now. And you say that it scares you. Well, if it needs to scare you into action, be scared as quickly as possible. And let me tell you how you can get scared to the necessary degree. Go to Walmart. Look at where anything you buy is manufactured, including what you eat. Is it inside of the United States or outside of the United States? And is it on the same hemisphere or in different hemispheres? Well, conduct such an experiment. See what happens. So if tomorrow your borders shut down, what are you going to eat? What are you going to wear? What are you going to buy? And I'm not even talking about other things. Okay, well, that would be the first reflection that we're already global. The second is that just dial up the telephone of customer service, of, let's say, iPod, or let's say any kind of other device you have. Let's say even your personal computer, which could be Hewlett Packard, for example. I can bet you the customer service will not be from the United States of America. They will just have an American name, but they will have a different accent. And I very often, by the type of the accent, I try to ascertain where people come from. So it is already global, and I would like to delve into the subject a little bit more. Can I?
Or
may I? Rather, may I?
Yes, you
when
may.
I started, thank you, thank you. Now I'm trying to be polite and not a rude Russian interrupting everybody in sight. It's because Russians get so passionate that we feel that if we interrupt, then we consider another person somebody we can trust. Because if we don't interrupt, that means we do not trust and consider the person an enemy. How is that?
I didn't know that.
You see, there are different cultural traits in different cultures. So when I started working in international business in the 90s, this is how international business happened. A large company usually could afford to go abroad. Small companies didn't tangle themselves with it, or they were just exploring. were on the sidelines, large companies, were those who went internationally. And here's how they did it. This is how Pepsi-Cola did it, and I saw it. This is Pepsi. This is how Pepsi did it. This is how Coca-Cola did it. This is how Raytheon did it. And this huge entity comes into another country and basically rebuilds American civilization, a mini American civilization on, let's say, on an island. And documentation, management style, materials, way of executing things were American. And they influenced other people. I remember very well how I was consulting Taco Bell's when they went to Russia. It's the same thing. They were superimposing their management styles, their ways of thinking onto Russia. And remember even a movie where Tom Hanks was thrown on the island alone, and I forgot the name of the movie. I think it was Alone or something of that nature. He was on the uninhabited island because he was a FedEx executive who just ended up on that island. But the beginning of the movie, he's training Russian workforce for FedEx, and he is training them in a very American fashion. It was wonderful for Russians to learn the ways of America, and they learned a lot. But nevertheless, it is you can only go that far if you are saying my way or the highway. What is happening today is qualitatively, fundamentally different of how you start a business. Let me give you an example. I have a student, young guy, 21 years old, nearing the millionaire status. I always ask him, what are you doing in my classroom? I mean, you don't need me. Oh, I need you because I need to learn from you. So here's what he does. He went to, just on a trip, went to Africa and decided that he wants to come up with a product that he wants to sell there. He went on a student trip, on internship, and comes back, and in order for him to sell that product, he needs to manufacture it somewhere. Where does he go? He goes to Alibaba.com, which is a company, which is an internet-based company that lists all the manufacturers throughout the world. He chooses a Chinese manufacturer. Before, let's say 10 years ago, you had to go to China. You had to talk to them. You had to build a relationship with them for a year at least. Not so anymore. Not so. Everything got streamlined. He found a manufacturer. He ordered the product, never got acquainted with those people. The product got shipped to the place in Africa with whom he worked, and the product is being sold there. So what is this if it's not global? So startups today, with whether they are manufacturing or whether they are consulting or whether they are doing some kind of, I don't know, brain work, they are more often than not, in fact, overwhelmingly more often than not, global. When you manufacture in one place, you ship through another company or another nation altogether, you sell in a different country, and that is, or you take an idea from a different country and you bring it here. So everything gets mixed up. As you said, a smoothie, a very nice smoothie is being formed as we speak. So how is that for businesses being global? Now, everything that can be outsourced, I said it before, I will say it again, everything that can be outsourced out of the United States will be outsourced or is in the process of being outsourced already or was already outsourced. What are we going to be left with? We are going to be left with a couple of industries that cannot be outsourced, but not everybody can work in these industries, such as, for example, medical care, such as taking care of the elderly in retirement homes and such like things. Okay, so what's left for us? What are we going to do? Okay, we can go into American education because it's still a very popular industry where people come to study to us. But I already went to Saudi Arabia, and I can tell you they're building universities, and they're paying a lot of money to American professors, and they are structuring their positions in such a way that obsolescence is built in into their jobs. So for 5 years, you have a villa, a chauffeur, a maid, and a huge salary. In 5 years, you're fired because they want you to train their own specialists. Okay, where does it leave us? What are we going to do? And by us, I mean us Americans. So please be scared. It's the very first step, the very first step, and a very, very constructive step.
Wow. Okay, so several things come to my mind, and one of them is going back to my, not that I'm afraid today, it's going to sound like it, though. What if the lights go out? What if the lights go out everywhere? What if things go haywire and the computer age falls flat, the internet stops, somebody puts a virus that eats everything, and, you know, we're not as connected anymore, and yet, you know, can that happen? I mean, what if all the, what if everything that we think is necessary, all this outsourcing and fracturing some of what we're doing by sending it away, can we be making a mistake?
Let me tell you, it's a wonderful question, and I am eager to answer it. And let me answer with the following. Several years ago, when I was still a political and Department of Defense advisor, I was at a classified conference because I was providing international services there. And the conference was about false alarms. And let me go into the depths. Hopefully it will be interesting for someone at least. Intercontinental ballistic missiles are nuclear rockets that can actually obliterate the whole of the United States and the whole globe very, very quickly. The capability is such that the United States can blow up the whole globe about 54 times, and Russians are claiming about 55 times. I do not know the exact numbers. They are approximate, but that is in that vicinity. I remember very well, over 50 times. So we have been sitting on a powder keg for several decades already. Now, a couple of times it already happened that the button was almost pushed. And not because people were so hostile against each other, but because they were just scared. For example, the Russians once saw the bunch of geese flying, and their computer systems took it as tridents attacking the territory of the Russian Federation. And the button was almost pushed. The button on the American side was almost pushed in 1982, if I'm not mistaken. That would have been the end of the world. And the relationship between Russia and the United States is built on the concept, don't laugh, because otherwise you would cry, on the concept of the mutually assured destruction. So the only thing that prevents us from pushing the button is the fact that the other side will have a couple of minutes to push it back, and that's it. Globe is done. When I was sitting at that conference, I actually thought, A, there is never be a time in our life on this globe that we are going to be self-sufficient or independent. Forget that. That's not possible. Because today it's not even real, it's not even reality anymore, even from the standpoint of military defense. Okay? Now, what can happen to other things? Same thing can happen as was happening, or, you know, as it was happening in the missile defense area. And let me tell you, that would have been not only a glitch, it would have been the end of this planet. I mean, not one country, but the planet. And since that did not happen, I thought two things. Either somebody is watching out for us, a higher power, and I shouldn't be worried about that anyway. And number two, the process is already underway. You cannot stop it. So you better go and build better systems. On the basis of the classified conference, there were attempts made to make these rockets almost impossible to launch without several safety mechanisms. So I think as the world network develops, the same is going to happen. The same is going to happen. We will be working on more and more reliable and verifiable systems, but you cannot turn the tide around. That's it. It's going only in one direction. And it's going and picking up speed, which makes us Americans much more vulnerable than others, because others have much less to lose than we do.
Okay,
yes. Uh-huh.
Well, I was going to say, the words that come to mind are fail-safe, the fail-safe mechanisms. When you're talking about making sure that mutually assured destruction is something that people take seriously, you know, there's some fail-safes in place to keep people from being able to just push buttons you know, there's things that have to happen in sequence and all that stuff, and who's got the keys and all that. I'm assuming. I've watched a lot of television and movies. But I think what I'm realizing is, as business people who do rely on others, you know, for our livelihood and who are concerned about others around the world, like I am, we have to have like a fail-safe plan, a fallback position, some backup, and be smart in case the ne'er-do-wells out there are doing things that are not in our best interest, you know, the people that want to harm not just one person, because I think we've talked about this before, the fact that the world is so small that you hurt one group of people, you hurt a lot of group of people by that ripple effect, right? So I guess I must be in a mood today where I'm worried about bad things happening. I don't know how I didn't wake up that way this morning, but it just sort of comes to me today, I guess. But,
can
you know,
I, yes, uh-huh.
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, I was just saying, go ahead, please.
I would like to comment exactly on that particular worry. And let me tell you how. On Sunday, staying in bed, and I will not, I mean, I had some dental work done, so I'd better put it on the table and confess to everybody that it has happened. I was watching a movie. The movie was an American movie. It was 1980s. And it was, if anybody knows or remembers, it was a very tense time in the relationship between the United States and America, I mean, United States and Soviet Union, and we were on the verge of nuclear war at that time. And people were talking about how worrisome it was, how difficult it was. And I was laughing. I said, people, you should be traveling to us at that time. And you should see how we are following you on the street, in the street, and we're trying to make you sell your jeans to us because we wanted them. So it is not American defense or military power that destroyed the Soviet Union. It was Wrangler jeans. It was Coca-Cola and other things. And let's say, I'm trying to come up, Led Zeppelin or Aerosmith. That's what actually destroyed the Soviet Union. I would not worry about these never-do-wells. And let me tell you why. What we should take care of is we should take care of ourselves. We should not rot from the inside. By living in the Soviet Union, I understood very, very quickly after I left it, I pondered and pondered about it, and reasonably quickly understood if the Soviet Union were not a country rotting from the inside, nothing could be done to that country. If you start rotting from the inside, nobody can help you. And we are rotting from the inside. It is plenty obvious to me. Why? Because when you survive the destruction of one huge empire, you always recognize the signs of decay in any other entity because you already saw it happening. You can recognize the symptoms of the disease. So that's the worry that we should have. And let me give an example, which I think I already gave before. Terrorism is a very dangerous thing for the United States. And I thought about it many, many times. It was dangerous. It remains dangerous. Why? It's because we make ourselves an easy target. Why? Because we're easily accused of being immoral, of being insufferable, of being absolutely decadent and carrying a very negative charge with us. Now, we Americans safely do not understand. We don't think about it. We don't think of ourselves in those terms. But nevertheless, it's already seeping in because I hear from people when I tell them, well, why don't you go to Russia or Asia or somewhere? They say, oh, but Americans are hated throughout the world. Well, I must say, we have a very compromised reputation, and for a very good reason. As I told you, come to a hotel, let's say in that very favorite country of Turkey of ours, turn on the TV, and you would see MTV, and let me tell you, that's what everybody's emulating. So let's not worry about them. Let's worry about us. And what we are doing is very worrisome. I remember very well when I came to the United States, and everybody showed me these plastic cards, and I couldn't understand what a plastic card meant. They say, do not ever get one. I say, well, if you don't want me to get one, why do you have it? They say, bad habit, bad habit. And that plastic thing turned out to be a credit card. And then it turned out that it's absolutely okay to owe money. I, with my old-fashioned psychology, couldn't even understand how it was possible. Who would give you that money? How can you go into debt? But Americans are very, very good at doing that, and that actually is catching up with us. So that's my take on where we are as far as dangers is concerned. I think it's not even comparable. I think the critical mass lies with us. And the critical mass is pretty bad at the moment. We're not out of the woods.
Okay, so I think then that the fail-safe mechanisms that as Americans can be put into place is doing the opposite of what you're talking about, which is moral decay, apathy, decadence, walking around with blinders, and maybe coming more fully engaged in the global family. In other words, not be so inward and selfish, let's say, if that's what's happening. And certainly, you know, the apathy is a big thing for me. You know, I think about how few people really vote in this country, and yet it's one of the rights that, my gosh, I can't believe people don't vote. I absolutely cannot believe they don't vote. I just can't believe it. And I think that'd be one thing that would be a great fail-safe, is for everybody to vote. Everybody. I don't care if you vote for the person that I don't want. I just want you to vote.
And can I then confess very openly to you that I am one of those Americans who do not vote? And can I give you my reasons why it is not happening?
Okay.
And let's see where it takes us. And I do not know what people think about it. But what I'm saying is, in my view, first of all, I would like to say that what in my view a fail-safe mechanism is for America is to go back to our roots, is to listen to the farewell address of George Washington. I mean, not to listen, but to read it, to understand that if you do not honor the cornerstone of your country, the foundation of your country, which is written on the Statue of Liberty, that's it. You cannot succeed because you're not going along the lines of your authenticity, of your true nature. Your true nature is not consumerism. It's your true nature not to load, not to pile boxes under the Christmas tree, which was a stagger. You should see the impression I had when I first saw it. I thought, these people must be totally, totally out of their minds. They must be crazy. They don't need 10 presents. One would be enough. So what I'm trying to say, that's where the foundation is. Now, let me put it on the table openly why I don't vote. I worked in Washington, and I was working in foreign policy development, and I saw with my own two eyes, and I'm putting it uncensored, how little one human or two humans can identify where the stream is going. More than that, I learned that in America there is a particular process that it's a college vote, it's not popular vote, and I do not quite understand the difference. Thank goodness I didn't even want to go into that. But what I understood, I became very indifferent to voting because I thought, if I, in my own place, become the best possible American I can be, I will bypass the government structure, and I will be more influential in a globalized world than any political structure can be. Now, I must tell you that part of me actually feels that you're right, and I should change my attitude, and I'm not particularly holding on to it. It's just, you know, either it's remnant of my childhood when I didn't think that anything can happen, or my misunderstanding about college vote versus popular vote. But I also saw that governments can do very little. It's people who do a lot, and people have more power. And you're absolutely right. They can express it either through vote or through being the best American they can possibly be. And who is it? Someone who is generous. Someone who understands that the country does not belong to them just because they were born there. But America belongs to somebody like me as much as it belongs to someone like you. That everybody is welcome to America, but the selective process is very serious and is not politically biased. Because, you know, Cuba refugees are as precious as Haiti refugees, but Haiti refugees are turned back. And the Cuba refugees, the Cuban refugees are allowed to stay in the country because of political agenda. So the less political America is, the less policeman in the world she is, the better she will be doing. But if she can embody those lofty ideals of not lying, not cheating, not padding the hours, because I can see how business ethics is just plummeting in America. Like before, you could just trust people. Even when I came, you could trust people. They will charge you honestly. And now it's inflated. You see? So that's my take. That's what I think.
Well,
not that I think that people should not vote, but the focus is on a personal effort, including globalization. It is a personal endeavor.
Right, and I think what I would like to add to that is the importance that I think being generous, honest, ethical, trustworthy, and a discerning, active, and informed citizen of my own nation, well, first my own community, because, you know, local judges and local laws and everything and all the things that they put on the ballot, initiatives and all that stuff, you do really have to pay attention and that's not let things happen that you don't want, right? But if you're active and informed as a citizen of your own local community, and then spread it out to the state and then the nation, I just think that makes for better, well-rounded, informed citizen of the world, in my opinion. And I just I personally don't feel that staying home on election day makes any sense at all. I just don't get it.
I'm just saying
that seems like the most adult. This is not about you or people that don't. I'm just saying for me, it's a very adult, responsible, well thought out process. You know, I personally get the ballot. I look at it, I study it, I talk to my husband about it for a while, not that we necessarily vote along the same lines, because sometimes we don't. And it becomes something that we pay attention. You know, we want to understand what's going on. And another thing, I have actually gone before city council and expressed my opinion on things. So obviously I have a propensity towards maybe some activism of some kind. So, you know, maybe I'm different, but I feel like at the very least, you know, voting is an opportunity to say, I have my ideas, I have my ideals, I am part of the process, I am not a problem. You know, I am here, and I've raised my hand, and I've said yes or no. And I just think that's just how I am, and I just would like to think more people would be concerned that so few people really vote when so many things are so important.
I cannot, actually, as I'm listening to you, I hear everything you say. Moreover, I agree with everything you say. And I promise you, by the way, that I will reconsider my practice. And I guess what I was trying to say, that I'm approaching everything from a totally different angle. I'm explaining, in a sense, why people become passive, because they think that nothing depends upon them. That's number one. And number two, that they can be active in many areas. So how about that? How about I change my practices and become a more active American, which, by the way, is very necessary for our nation. But may I now ask you vehemently to understand that you should not divide people between Americans and non-Americans. For example, is that you would say, well, everybody is watching us. Yes, true. Fundamentally, there is no difference between an American and non-American. We're all humans. In other words, you will include, and America needs to include not only America now into his inner circle, but he needs to include others as well and be proactive. And let me give you an example of that. You know, I was in Arizona, and I was very much amazed by those very tall fences that American government is trying to erect not to allow immigrants to come in from the southern borders. And I was laughing to myself. I was thinking, are you guys crazy? This is the same planet. If life is better in one corner than another corner, of course that corner is going to become popular. And the higher fences you erect, the less security you're going to have because your security lies in a totally different area. More than that, if you lock yourself away from Mexico, what is going to happen to you is that they will sell you drugs, and your drugs will poison the nation from the inside. In other words, if you want to pretend that somebody else does not exist, or you want to protect your better standard of life and not help the other one to achieve the same standard of life, woe to you. You will never win. Never, never, never win. And America was such a phenomenally successful civilization because it allowed people to come and then turned on a natural selection process. Whoever survives, survives. Whoever doesn't survive, does not survive. And because of that, it actually became what it is. But now it's trying to change its direction. And therefore, it doesn't. It loses in globalization tremendously. Let me give you an example. In order for a foreign satellite to be launched on an American launcher, a lot of things need to be taken into account. It's very difficult. It's very bureaucratic. Therefore, Russia now launches more satellites with France, China, India. So we are forming, by we, now I mean outsiders, not Americans, we are forming alliances to where we do not allow you to come. So who is losing? America is losing. Now, as I told you, there are a lot of alliances in, let's say, robotics between Russia and Dubai. Even when you go to conferences in software development to Dubai, a lot of signs are in Russian. And there are a lot of alliances that are geographically confined to that region. And the Americans have no idea that it's happening. Where do they find themselves? Where do we find ourselves, my fellow Americans? Jump on a bandwagon before it's too late, and we will prompt you how to do it.
Right, right. Well, there's lots of moving parts, that's for sure. I mean, like you're saying, the satellite issue, and earlier we were talking about the Internet and all the ways that we can optimize our lifestyles, our businesses and our ways to make money and help other people and all that stuff are all dependent on what's happening at all corners of the globe. And I don't think that everybody realizes that they can play on a bigger scene, you know, a bigger stage if they just knew what to do.
We can explain what to do. Definitely. We do not even need to explain what to do. Let them discover it, or let them, or let you, whoever is listening, ask us questions. You ask us what you're struggling with in this issue of globalization. Do you understand? Do you feel that you don't have a place? We'll tell you what your place is. Do you feel that you're afraid of it and don't know how to go there? We will explain to you how to do it. But because we have such a large country surrounded by two oceans, it did not sink in yet that we'd better move. That the fact that we can't be self-sufficient is an illusion. An illusion is gone, and it has already happened, and we don't know it yet. And if we don't, then no. Okay, and what to do with our future success? If you're safe where you are right now and don't need to do anything, please, you don't need to do anything. But you have children. What kind of education are you going to give to them? Which universities are they going to go to? Which professions are they going to get? It is a fact already that universities do not keep up with the professions that are necessary. So, again, here is the catch. Even if you yourself are satisfied with where you are, what about your children? What are you going to do about them? We can explain to you what to do with them.
Right.
Are we we can advise them where to go or
right.
how to be.
Exactly.
And I would like to give, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
What I wanted to say, the first advice, non-negotiable, by all means, the child needs to study at least one, preferably two or three foreign languages, starting the age of 7 at the latest, preferably starting at the age of 4, and going all the way to 18, and then continue through college age uninterruptedly. Then another advice is to spend the money at least on one semester, and that's a minimum, actually it's not even enough, on studying at some foreign university in the foreign language, not in English, but in the language of that particular nation, because then you will see that you're not an American. You can be a Spaniard. You can be a Frenchman. You can be an Italian simultaneously with being an American. We immigrants, we already know it. So we are already at an advantageous position. But those who are born in the United States can be at a very strong disadvantage in comparison with us, and we are trying to level the playing field. So no education is good enough without reading in foreign languages, without knowing poetry in that language, because it will reflect to you how other people tick. If you do not learn how other people tick, you will never understand yourself, and you will never understand your own cultural advantage. And cultural advantage we already talked about. It's extremely important for us to understand it.
You're making me think of something very interesting about a woman that I know who is, she's a Turkish national, married to a United States Marine. I don't believe she ever became a citizen. At the time that I knew her, she had not. And she was able to tell and understand jokes in English, even though English is not her first language, and has the most amazing sense of humor in two languages. And I was jealous of that because I only have a sense of humor in one. See what I'm saying? You have the same benefit. You have an amazing sense of humor, and you can understand and appreciate nuance and, you know, the concept of jokes and everything else very well. And I'm jealous. I only have one language. I could speak French if I went back and studied it for a little while, because I had 4 years of it in high school. I could get well enough in there, but I'm certainly not going to be able to understand jokes. So I think that's something definitely would be very, very helpful for our students coming up to understand why they needed to just go immerse yourself in a language other than your own home language, native language. I love that idea.
Can I even throw an idea in addition to that? And thank you very much for being so kind as far as my sense of humor. I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm being facetious. But
I know you're being facetious, but I have heard you speak, and one of the things that is the most endearing about your stage presence is your dose of humor when you're talking about things that are pretty serious. You know, you have a very, very great way with words in the English language, and English is not your first language. And so I admire that. I just want to put that on the record. I admire that a lot.
You know what I think the future is going to be? In the future, everybody is going to speak English. But what is highly advisable for people whose first language is English is actually speak other languages, one or two, or no other languages, as well as English. And it is much more possible. There is a psychological barrier in Americans, and as a linguist I've seen it many times, that another language cannot be learned well without going to the country or living in the country. The majority of the Soviet Union graduates never saw an alive American. Well, not that they saw dead Americans, but they never said they have never seen a breathing American, or they never saw a breathing American. I'm sorry, my grammar is not good today. But what I'm saying is it's not necessary. You already understand the heart of that nation. And here's why it is so important. People can say, well, I talked to a FedEx executive one time, and he said, which language am I supposed to study? I mean, one day I'm in, let's say, Luxembourg, and another day I'm in Denmark, and another day I'm in Indonesia, and another day I'm in India. And I said, it doesn't matter. By studying one foreign language, you automatically become global. Why? Because for the first time in your life, you actually understand that there is a total different system of engines on which people drive their cars, and they do not look like your engine. They do not function like your engine, but they drive you really well. And you will understand the fundamental equality of everything. You will see the strong parts of that language. So that's number one. And number two, every other language is progressively easier and easier and easier to study. Very often in America, when I would be talking to people and them telling me about studying foreign languages, they will say something like this. Instead of, well, I read poetry in French, they sometimes will say, well, I took 4 semesters of French. And I always want to say, it doesn't matter how many semesters you took. What I want to know is how much you understand of that language. And can I even throw an idea on the table? It doesn't matter how late it is in life. It doesn't matter how far off you think you are. You will be much quicker, not you personally, but in general, what I'm trying to say, and I'm speaking from experience as a practicing linguist who has to study languages all the time. You become much quicker in perceiving that language than you think you can or you think you are. Much, much quicker. It's that Americans are perfectionists, I must say. And Americans do not respect the process. Americans respect all the results. And that is a part of American national character that definitely needs to be adjusted. Respect the process. Do not chase the result, darn you, because you raise so much dust around you that the result is even further delayed. So there must be a balance there. And in studying foreign languages, that's where it kills Americans, because they want results. And they need to love the process. And for that matter, they need to have enough time for the process. And we are building now into the question of different time perceptions of different cultures and the cultural advantage of cultures who always think they have enough time. French, for example, will never shortchange their lunch because they think they have enough time. And guess what? They do. We, on the contrary, never think that we have enough time. And therefore, it shows in our bodies. And therefore, we spend enormous amount of money on trying to lose weight. And if we thought that we had enough time to have lunch, maybe we will be much, much better. In fact, not maybe, for sure. We will be much better, even as far as our sizes are concerned. And we have formidable sizes, I must admit. In other words, it's our national struggle. We struggle. We try right. to pretend we don't, but we do. We do. We do. I see it. We do. And I always want to scream and say, please, please, please promise me you will sit down and eat. Promise me that you will not worry about the future so that it doesn't cost you eating additional sugar.
Well, here's what comes to my mind. I think that I am multilingual by default. Now, we started out talking about being global by default, but I want to say this. I know the language of a lot of things. I know the language of various industries. I know the language that includes the buzzwords of certain kinds of things that I write about. I'm a technical writer, so I can write on any subject. You give me enough time to do a little research. I learn the buzzwords and the language specific to that industry or that genre, and I'm in it. I am absolutely immersible, right? So for me, the idea of relearning my French and then knowing that Spanish would follow very easily, almost, you know, to, like falling off a log, is exciting. Now, trying to learn Japanese or Chinese is a little more of a challenge, but I personally don't mind a challenge. So that has been on my to-do list for 2 decades, to learn Japanese. I haven't started it, but I know that I shall. So do you understand what I mean, though, by being multilingual in terms of our own, how we communicate in various different lanes. You know, I speak differently to my husband than I do to you on the radio than I do to you as a friend on a phone call, right? So does that make sense, or am I making this up?
No, it makes, not only it makes perfect sense, it makes my linguist's heart sing. I don't know whether people are going to hang up at this moment, but I would like to say that studying foreign languages is not at all different from the process that you just described. The whole language thing is a continuum. There are many, many languages inside of one English. First of all, British English, as people very well, hopefully they understand it very well, is very different from American English. It is a different sensibility. This language is born on a different territory. It reflects that territory, that nation, that climate, those flowers. American English is very different. More than that, Bostonian English is different from, let's say, Utah English. And I definitely say Arkansas is different from California English. So,
but yeah, I just said falling off a log. I'm pretty sure they don't say that in Boston.
Or, you know, remember the expression that you taught us, I am going through something like General Grant through Richmond. I laugh. I actually love that expression. I use it several times, and I shock people around me because in Utah they don't understand it, but I immediately got it. And it's surprising because each Western town has Grant Avenue. In other words, the name of Grant is very well known, but there is no Richmond of the kind that was meant in that saying. So
yep.
You are absolutely correct. That's number one. And number two, to talk about your desire to study Japanese. You know, it's interesting that Americans and you, as an American, you say, I want to learn Japanese. We don't need to have the goal of having learned Japanese. We need to have a goal of studying Japanese. That is a fundamental difference in how American culture sees the process of learning and how we from the East, because, you know, I represent Eurasia, because Japan, China, Far East and Russia, we're close in our mentality. We concentrate on the process, and the process gives us pleasure. But in order for the process to give us pleasure, we need to have enough time. And the moment I land in America, I feel that the clock sped up 10 times. Rush.
You do realize that the difference between the words study and learn is the time and the results. When I say my goal is to learn Japanese, I don't want to just study it and then not be able to speak it or read it. I want to learn it. See the difference? Isn't that amazing?
I do. And I wanted to actually point out that very difference to you, that if you have the goal of learning Japanese, you will never start speaking it. If you have the goal of studying Japanese, you will start speaking it immediately. Because even if, and I saw it with the students, I tried to teach foreign language, in the cultures where studying is the focus, they immediately started using it because they do not expect perfection. In the cultures where learning, So what I'm trying to say is if you have the goal of learning, until you recite poems perfectly, you will never open your mouth and start speaking it. And as a linguist, I need to say that it is necessary to start speaking it within two words. Two words is already enough. Hello and goodbye. Every culture has hello, every culture has goodbye. And that needs to be used immediately. If you know 10 words, you need to use them immediately. You need to start reading Japanese your first week of studying Japanese or Chinese. And gradually, the mind gets used to a different way of seeing the universe. And that's what makes you such a great global businessman or a global citizen. And I can see, looking at a person, I can usually see whether they succeed globally or not. Just a little bit of a conversation, I already know they will or they won't. And some won't.
Right.
Too steeped into one way of thinking, too steeped into a particular way of how the universe looks. Because if you sit on a Japanese, bench, your universe might look differently. or the vantage point of a Russian is different. The vantage point of a Norwegian is different. And you know, we're not even talking about Arkansas. Arkansas viewpoint could be very different.
All right, so. Now let me try something in Turkish for you and see. Do you know very much Turkish?
Whatever I could master, I used immediately.
Okay. So I believe to ask the waiter for the check in a restaurant is the following. I believe it is, Hesaba gerir misiniz? Okay. Now, when I that woman that I told you that I know from Turkey, I worked with her, and at the time we were working, I was answering the phones at a company in Oceanside, California. That was my temporary job when I first came to California years ago. And whenever her mother would call from Turkey, if Saral was not available, nobody would be able to say anything to her except in English. So she wanted me to be able to tell her mother that she had gone to lunch and that she would be back in 1 hour. And I would say, Saral yemekte bir saat sonra ora. And that means Saral has gone to eat. She'll be back in 1 hour.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Now, am I global or what?
Oh, must be very global. Including our most favorite country of Turkey, which we are revisiting in our conversations quite often.
So, I'm just laughing because I don't know why I remember that, but I do. All right, so...
People always remember certain phrases in another language, and it's extremely important to remember because you become even more Turkish. I do not know what your relationship with Turkey was when you were growing up because you told me that the driver was trying to drive you off the road, and I still am wondering why he wanted to do that.
No. That was in Iran. I lived in Iran.
I see.
Turkey was fabulous. Turkey was fantastic. I was older. I was 12, 13, 14 years old in Turkey. No, my first grade was in Iran, and that bus driver tried to pretty much run me over every day. It was sport. I don't know why. Now, let's go back through language. Just one more thing. There are some things that we say in America that are, you know, they're good. It's a good thing, but it could be bad in other cultures. You know, something that's unseemly or rude. And how do we handle that? You know, when you don't really know that you're doing it, it's an accident.
You know, that is a very, very good question. Well, first of all, those who speak English as the first language, I'm citing with my American citizenship now, we run the danger of speaking American English internationally. That should never be done. Because American English and English are two different entities. Let's say American English, British English, and international English are different entities. And there is a concept of international English that all of us in the world speak. Now, that is why it is sometimes difficult for Americans to operate in their own language when they go abroad, is because we foreigners, we speak a different brand of English, and we do not understand Americanisms. So the first rule of thumb is to speak neutral English without colloquial expressions or without particular American concepts. Now, how can we understand what concepts are purely American and which concepts are not? We cannot. If we do not understand others, if we don't curious about them, if we don't look at them when we go there, if we do not observe them, that's it. Consider us dead meat. We will be going nowhere, no matter how much we speak English. But if we observe others, if we suspend our judgment, if we watch our emotional reactions, which are inevitable because emotional reactions in exposure to culture is always there, and it's always very, very strong, then we have a chance to succeed. Partially in using English. So the first rule of thumb is suspend your American English. Speak neutral international English, where you are not an American, where you are a human using English to communicate to another human. And it's so funny because the English language did become the language of communication. I'm talking to my Brazilian colleague right now. And which language do I use? English. Had I not spoken English, had she not spoken English, we would never be able to talk to each other. I work with a company in Italy. Which language do we use? English. And again, it's a particular brand of English, not American English. Not American English, I repeat. Now, people do learn American English with Americanisms, and I would love to talk about them a little bit. For example, Americans are very, very strong about results, and Americans very much value athleticism. And it is reflected in their language very strongly. During contractual negotiations, I very often hear people say, oh, give me the ballpark number. Now, no foreigner would ever say that. It is an American expression. Foreigners don't use it at all. We don't even understand what it means. Or, for example, an American would say, I cannot tell you this right off the bat. Which bet? What is this bet? We have no idea what this bet is. So those who speak English are not necessarily Americans. My fellow Americans, remember it. Your version of English is your American version. It's not global English. Global English is different, and global English is devoid of everything that is purely American way or attitude to life. But on the other hand, if you study American English, you very quickly understand what Americans are after, how Americans are. How Americans are wired, and that's very, very useful. For example, there are many expressions that came from the United States. I never knew that there was an expression, bonds of steel, until I actually landed in America. And I thought, what is this, prosthetics of some sort? No, it's what Americans want to have. I couldn't understand why they're so preoccupied with a particular body part that needs to be made of steel. And why does it need to be made of steel? What is this obsession with this steel? And later on I learned that one of the features of American national character, reflected in American English, is absolute body obsession. And I couldn't believe to what lengths this obsession goes. And I must admit, we Europeans are much easier in that area, and we do not want to get this disease from Americans, and we want to resist as much as we possibly can because we're afraid that it will kill us, as it already killed you. So how is that for the end of our conversation?
Well, it's great, but I want to make a couple of points when you're talking about body obsession. So if somebody says, oh, my gosh, you just put your foot in your mouth, you know, that is one of those things that would be American English. You know, do you put your foot in your mouth? Probably not. So that's one thing. The other thing is talking about regional English. There are sayings from my Arkansas family that are so bizarre. I haven't even tried them on you because you would just look at me like, oh, my gosh, I have no idea what you're talking about. I can give you one example. There's an expression that one of my uncles used to use when he wanted a side dish. It's funny how we keep coming back to food almost every time we talk, probably because it's lunchtime. But he wanted a side dish on his plate, and he did not want any gravy on it. He did not want any sauce on it. And he would ask my grandmother to put it on the plate, dry along so. That's three words that don't go together. He's the only person I ever knew that said it, and I looked it up about a week ago on Google, and was actually able to find it in one blog that somebody was doing in Idaho or Iowa. But dry along so. My point is, if I say I want my something-something dry along so, you're going to look at me in Utah where you live like you have no idea what I'm talking about, right? So it's the same thing to be aware of who you're talking to and what colloquialisms do for you, because sometimes it doesn't do much. And my last point is this. As a global writer, you know, somebody that wants people to be able to understand my writing, come to my website and partake of my offerings and so forth, I believe I have to clean up and suspend some of my American English and even some of my friendliness issues. For example, if you use contractions like I'll instead of I will, that does not translate. It does not translate. So if somebody can click on their little translation machine and put my words in, and I have put things in it that don't translate, I have left money on the table, potentially. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense, and you are absolutely correct. And that's where one of the global business opportunities is if because we're becoming globalized, and if other companies are serving American customers, they actually need to adjust their style, and they don't know how to do it yet. They need to adjust their style of communication to the style of American communication, which is much less hierarchical, much less formal, much friendlier, and that has not been done yet. Somebody has to take this opportunity and develop it, and we will help you. We will tell you what needs to be done. But customer service in other countries, you can immediately understand that they are not very effective because they do not have this American style of communication. And that's where we could start our new discussion next time.
That's exactly what I was going to say. We could talk about how to adjust our style for a global interaction. How does that sound? That sounds very interesting.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, Tyera, it has been wonderful as always. Thank you so much for joining me on this hour. And I look forward to next week when we talk about how we adjust for basically the big win, because I believe that everybody wins. This is the 21st century win-win, in my opinion, is to just figure out what to do, how to do it, and how to make it comfortable for other people to not only understand us, but to engage, buy, collaborate, cooperate, all of that. Does that make sense? Is that what we're doing?
Makes a lot of sense. Yes, that's what we're doing.
All right. Well, I think we can pretty much call it a day, and you have a very good week, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Go Global Fast with Dr. Tyera Kovaleva and Deborah Brown. Tune in every Monday for another hour of Globalization Success Strategies. Go Global Fast is a production of the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.